You are listening to Retheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Colson. This is Minute 106. This minute begins with the Prometheus preparing to take off and ends with the Prometheus crashing into the Juggernaut. Yannick ejects Vicar's module, and we see that it is actually placed centrally on the back of the ship, so it's actually kind of like a tick on its back. We see no other escape pods deployed, so I guess everyone else in the crew decided to die. And I know, I'm so bothered by this plot. I know I've already talked about it, I'm so bothered by it that I decided to go back and dig a little deeper. So, it's not known how big the crew was, but in the initial meeting we can see that there are 15 crew members. Now, only about 5 or 6 of those are confirmed dead at this point. Yannick, Vickers, Ravel, and Chance will soon be dead. That leaves Elizabeth, David, and anywhere between 3 to 6 other crew members. And why I give that margin is because there are actually 18 crew members credited on IMDb. But even that might not be everyone. I think they missed an opportunity here to humanize and heighten the tension. If we saw the last crew members suddenly faced with this news and watching them have to make this decision, slow death or quick death, I think that would have been brilliant. And, you know, I can understand creators not wanting to focus on a particular thing because that's not the story they're trying to tell, but if you introduce an element, you need to work with it. You've got crew members hanging around. Resolve that somehow. Kill them off before getting to this point. Have them all make a decision here. Do something. You have to kind of tie all the loose ends. You can't just leave it. Otherwise, some obsessive fan like myself is going to notice and complain. But no, I actually do feel, even if someone doesn't consciously think about it, when a film is very methodical and thoughtful and does seem to resolve everything it sets up, even if you aren't consciously aware of it, I think the audience responds to that. They pick up on it. You know, how many times have you watched a movie and gone, oh yeah, I forgot about that. Oh, cool. Okay, so that's a clever way to solve that. We cut to Vicar struggling to get her boots on. She has 20 seconds to evacuate. This is just ridiculous. You know, as I said in the last minute, this is a bad system if you need to escape in an emergency. There's a reason why in real life emergencies, like a fire, you're told to leave and not waste time trying to bring all these things with you. There should be as little time as possible between detecting a problem and responding to it. Vickers gets out with 8 seconds to spare. The editing in the third act has some problems for me. I haven't really noticed editing up until now. I think it's been pretty standard. It hasn't done anything too unusual. And it hasn't had any obvious problems, but this is where it starts to stand out to me, and not in a good way. And I'll get more into this when we get to the scene where Vickers and Shaw run away from the Juggernaut, but the main problem is clarity. Clarity of action, you know, making it easy for us to follow what is actually going on and making sense of the plot being told. So right here, I find myself still confused by this sequence of events, despite knowing this plot very, very well by now. So watching Vickers trying to get into a suit while we see the module being deployed, to me, makes it seem like she's inside that module. I'm convinced every single time that this room is somewhere inside the module. I just keep forgetting and defaulting to, oh yeah, she's in a module now. No, she's... I keep falling for it. I can't put the blame entirely on the editing, because having a module and an escape pod is just unnecessary. But how it's presented to us in the sequence doesn't really illuminate anything until much later. It's not really until you see the module go, and then you're probably thinking, oh, I guess she's in there? No, and then you see her get into the escape pod, she lands, you see the module and the escape pod, and you're like, oh, I guess you did that. Why? Editing isn't really my expertise, so I'm not sure what they should have done here to make the best of a bad situation. I don't know, maybe just don't show the module at all. We've already established through dialogue what's going to happen to it, or maybe through some ADR dialogue, explaining that Vickers needs to get to an escape pod, just make that clear that these are two distinct things. I don't know. When Meredith lands and gets out of the pod, every single time I see it, I feel like Shaw's expression is like, oh god, not this bitch. I mean, she's probably just in pain, but she looks so done. And this minute ends with Yannick shouting hands off and everyone has their arms in the air like they just don't care and then they die. Yep. I wonder though, could the engineer see this happening? It's got all these fancy sensors and stuff. I'm sure it knew what was going to happen, right? But it doesn't try to alter its course in any way. I mean, it's possible it detected this and assumed the Prometheus wouldn't leave a dent on it, and it's true, it doesn't, but it still knocks it out of the sky. The engineer ship moves in a way we would expect a terrestrial ship to. You know, it really follows, it really obeys the laws of gravity and physics. But I've always been a fan of the way flying saucers move, almost like a prop on a wire, you know, just impossibly fast and smooth. They turn on a dime, as most UFO documentaries like to say. Granted, if something moves in an impossible way, then it's a lot harder to make it look convincing when you're animating it. I mean, sometimes real things can look unreal. Have you ever seen a shoebill stork? Looks like a man in a goddamn Big Bird costume. I am not joking. I'm gonna put a photo in the footnotes, but it just does not look like it should exist in reality. And I can imagine if you're trying to animate it to look real, so not making a CGI cartoon, but you're making CGI for live action of a shoebill stork. I think most people are just like, that looks like a cartoon. That doesn't look real at all. It's just too goofy to live. And so I guess, coming back to my initial point, by making spaceships move in a way that we understand physics to work, they can make it look more weighty and more realistic. Even though theoretically, maybe there is a way to make ships move the way UFOs do, but we just don't understand that. That's just beyond anything that we understand or that we are accustomed to. So, you know, if an alien saw a movie where a UFO was moving like that, they go, yep, that's how it works. Whereas that looks so fake. So I think there is an element where it is subjective. It is very much about we learn how physics work through our everyday life. Anyway, that's about all I have to say for this minute. It's not a lot, but I've decided to take this time to summarize the last pages of the scripts. The Prometheus script plays out virtually the same, although it explicitly describes a deacon as being the same creature as seen in the mural, which, yeah, I don't feel that changes too much about my preconceptions. I've always felt like, this is a ritual that the engineers have done, and they have seen a xenomorph before, and clearly, or a deacon specifically, and clearly when an engineer is used as a host, a deacon comes out. This is the very last page of the Prometheus script, and this is kind of interesting. Interior, Juggernaut 2. Orrery room, unknown. The engineer suit opens up, revealing David's body. The helmet attaches from David's head, which then drops and rolls onto the platform. The four cryopods rise up and one opens, revealing Shaw inside. She sits up and grunts and gasps. She looks around in confusion. David. Dr. Shaw, are you all right? What happened? Our presence is wanted outside. What? Arrived where? We've arrived. What arrived where? Paradise. She lets out a gasp. David, you're not being very helpful. Where? We have arrived at the place. Where? Who's on first base? Who's on first? Who's on first? Who is on first? I kind of like that. It kind of shows that whilst they did plan these things in advance, they were planning on going to the Engineer Planet. But I think I like the ending that we got because it is more open-ended where you don't know are they going to make it, what's going to happen. Engineers ends with Shaw getting in an escape pod, landing, running from the Juggernaut alone. She passes out, wakes up, looks over at the opening of the Juggernaut, and there stands a fully grown Ultramorph. She gets up, runs, they get into a fight. It's actually seen feeding on the engineer corpse, which, you know, xenomorphs and related creatures aren't supposed to eat anything, so, Here's the exact quote. Finding the rotting engineer's head among the shards of its vat, it begins to feed on the head, growing as she watches. Then Shaw impales it on some kind of saw blade. And later, apparently Shaw has time for arts and crafts. Well, Shaw slash Watts, I keep calling it. You know what I mean. Watts arrives at Vickers' module. The ultramorph alien's head has been affixed like a grisly trophy above the door. I don't know how you would have skinned that considering it has acid blood. I'm frankly impressed. I mean, predators do it all the time. We know that. We saw that in Predator 2, but I mean, this is sure. Never even seen an acid-blooded alien before, so I'm quite impressed. And here's the final page or so. Interior, Vickers' suite, shipwreck, day. Watts strips off her spacesuit. She helps herself to a glass of vodka from the bar. A chessboard sits atop the grand piano, a game in progress. David, voiceover, filtered. I've decided. Rook takes bishop. Watts nods, makes the move on the board, says nothing. He can't see you nodding, Watts. David, have you decided on our arrangement? I'm not going to fix you, David. I don't need you. I'll hold out. A ship will come. I'm certain. But who will send it? Men or engineers? Watts falls silent, stares unhappily at the chessboard. Dr. Watts, it's your move. Exterior, central crater, night. The massive central pyramid rises in the midst of the engineer complex. With a boom, a bright beam of light shines forth from its peak, punching straight up through the clouds like a laser. Various pyramids around LV-426. Oh yeah, it takes place on LV-426, I keep forgetting that. Other beams of light erupt from other pyramids, scorching the sky with their brightness. Exterior LV-426 orbit. The barren moon hangs in space, its father planet an angry red god in the background. 2 dozen beams of light rise from the moon, visible even from space. A beacon, a signal, a beginning. So, there's some interesting changes there, like Watts is more sensible and going, no, David, I know you're an insane murder bot, so I'm not exactly inclined to repair you and, you know, give you your murder hands back. But at the same time, it's just, you've only got 2 years of life. Well, I don't know if that rule is in this script, but theoretically, you've got a limited amount of life on this shipwreck of a module. And it's not likely that humans are even going to know where you ended up. It's a top secret mission. Does anyone know where you are? Is anyone going to look? I don't think so. And are they going to get there in time is the more important question. So you're more than likely going to encounter engineers. Is that what she wants? Does she want to draw them here? So the implications of the ending of this script are quite interesting because she's trying to lure people to LV-426. Which is sort of playing on the initial themes of the original Alien. So kind of reversing it a bit, the engineers will come to LV-426 to respond to a beacon. The Paradise script ends the same way the movie does. In fact, it's closer to what we get in the Prometheus script. So it's like they tweaked it and then undid that and went back to the previous draft and just went, actually, no, that works fine. The only notable difference here is that the trilobite is called the troglobite. That's basically it. I mean, troglobite, it's a made-up word, obviously referring to troglodyte, which I don't even know if that's an official term anymore. It refers to early modern humans or our closest ancestors. Trilobite is a very unrelated prehistoric creature that looks like a... there's different words for it, like a slater, I think there's another word for them, but in Australia we call them slaters. I think trilobite works, even though it doesn't make any freaking sense. Yeah, I'm just used to calling it that by now. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Alien Prequels by Minute on Facebook. You can also search Prometheus by Minute still, and that will send you to the same page. If you'd like to become a Patreon supporter, head on over to patreon.com/traviandesigns. Thanks to patrons Mark Bodo, Tariq William Elcott, Simon Haynes, and Graham Malcolm.